participating. So we will go ahead and proceed. And I'll call the case. It's case number 79603, Wilbert Knight versus the state of Nevada. And we have Mr. Resch representing the appellant, Ms. Lucich representing the respondent. Mr. Resch, did you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
2 minutes if possible, thank you.
Yes, okay, and then we'll just, as you're off, you see it get to 2 minutes left on the clock, you need to stop talking then like that, and we'll reserve it for you then. Okay?
Understood.
Okay, Mr. Resch, you may proceed. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'm Jamie Resch here on behalf of Wilbert Knight. We've got a lot of issues raised in this appeal, but I think we'll focus our time today on the related issues of the right to counsel and the motion for severance. With respect to those, we can take a quick look at why there was a right to counsel, why it was violated by conflict of interest, and then, of course, what we should do about it. I hope the first two questions don't trouble us too long. There's a credible case to be made that every post-indictment proceeding in a Nevada criminal case is a critical stage proceeding. If we don't want to go that far, we could certainly conclude the motion to sever here was simply based on the fact that it was opposed by the state, vigorously litigated. There were three hearings at the trial court level before the motion was ultimately denied, and it was something that greatly impacted Mr. Knight's fate. Based on all that, we should be able to conclude that the motion to sever was a critical stage proceeding. Given that, Mr. Knight would have then had a right to counsel, which I will again urge was violated when he was given counsel with a conflict of interest. The right to counsel, of course, means conflict-free counsel. Here, Mr. Knight and his co-defendant, Quincy, had a conflict, which is expressed in the entire concept that their defenses were asserted to be antagonistic. Mr. Knight, of course, arguing that Quincy might have placed property at Mr. Knight's house, and Quincy, of course, contending that Mr. Knight would have done that himself. So if we take stock of where we're at just really briefly, we've hopefully established there was a motion to sever, it was a critical stage proceeding, and there was a conflict of interest when Mr. Knight was represented by Quincy's lawyer. So the question then becomes, what do we do about it? Our position on that is twofold, and this really just keeps coming back to Cronick and Chapman and the other related Supreme Court cases, which have said the denial of counsel at a critical stage proceeding affects a right so basic, it's structural error, end of sentence. So if we start with that, we wouldn't be breaking any new ground here to conclude that there was structural error when Mr. Knight was represented by a lawyer who had a conflict of interest. Much of the state's brief focuses on exactly what the Supreme Court has said not to do, which is try to balance the so-called niceties of the error against how counsel would have helped or what they would or wouldn't have done. All of that is sort of out the window when there's structural error. And so our first position would simply be the cure for this, if there's going to be one, is a new trial because it was structural and there's well established in the Supreme Court cases that the remedy is you do the case over. Now, I'm not ignorant to the fact that there's sort of a white elephant in the room, which is the court held a motion for rehearing at the trial court level where Mr. Knight was represented by his own attorney, not Quincy's attorney. And so we should consider, did that affect anything that I've just said? And I would say that it
did not.
Mr.
Resch, Mr. Resch, this is Justice Silver in Las Vegas. And as to that point on the reconsideration, counsel, Mr. Coca, was there during that hearing. And didn't the district court afford him every opportunity at that point to make whatever arguments that might be in conflict with the other co-defendant? Wasn't he given an opportunity at that point?
Yes. All right. But let me break it into two parts. He is given an opportunity, but it's not the same full and fair opportunity the one would have had if you were actually considering the motion from the ground up.
Isn't our case law that at every juncture of a trial, even at trial, we've had cases that even at closing argument, that the district court always has a duty to consider motions to sever throughout trial because something may come up. And here, there was yet another opportunity.
It may have that duty, but it didn't exercise it at any time other than during the motion for rehearing, which I guess I would point out, number one, the state opposed. Their whole position below was that they couldn't even have the rehearing, and if you're going to have a rehearing, it was rehearing in the sense that this has already been heard and decided. Let's approach it from a question of, I guess, rehearing is what we'll call it, whether there was something new or something missed, referencing page 243 in the record where that appears. Also, the judge's comments throughout that proceeding were the same, that he would so-called humor the rehearing, but that this was something that he'd already decided and made his mind up on. We're not asking for any sweeping new rule here, just for the court to find that simply based on this record, the remedy given, if we're going to call it that, which was a remedy, a rehearing under objection by the state, was insufficient to cure the constitutional error, which was at the structural level. Now, lest that sound too extreme, there is some support for what I'm saying, and I apologize that I didn't find this case until I was working on the oral argument, realized this would probably be a really big question the court would want to have an answer to. But I would direct your attention to Williams versus Pennsylvania. It's 136 Supreme Court 1899. Short version of the Supreme Court case. There was a criminal case in Pennsylvania at which the a judge on the state Supreme Court had apparently acted as the district attorney in a criminal case, and then many years later, of course, heard the appeal from that same defendant. So the case was that the judge heard the case, was on the panel, and relief was denied. 2 weeks after that, the judge retired, and the defendant moved for rehearing basically on that issue, said, look, this was a conflict of interest. I should be able to present my case to an unbiased court. That petition was denied. It made its way all the way to the Supreme Court, and what they concluded was that the case had to be re-argued in full to the state Supreme Court, and this was true even though it had already been argued once before, even though the unbiased court, without that judge who had the conflict, had denied the motion for re-argument. Now, this isn't a perfect comparison, but similar cases are very hard to find. And number two, it does kind of tend to show that the trial judge's position here, that he would rehear it, but nothing that was going to be said would change his mind, does not cure the Sixth Amendment violation. There's a remedy in these types of cases. It's a full and complete do-over of the proceeding, not a limited do-over or rehearing.
Mr. Rash, but didn't he get, he got a rehearing. He got a rehearing on the issue that you're concerned he had a conflict on or had conflicted counsel. So he had an opportunity to do that hearing with his own counsel, so to cure that conflict, and had an opportunity to enhance his own papers. So why wouldn't we just be evaluating that rehearing to see if the judge got that right?
Well, again, for hopefully all the reasons I just stated, number one, that the case law at the highest level, Supreme Court, says that it's structural error to do the hearing over. Number two, to the extent that the hearing was done over, it wasn't done over in a full and fair way. It was done over everybody sort of approaching it as, look, we've already made up our mind. We're just going to do a rehearing, searching for things that were missed or new facts that were presented, not a full do-over.
Well, let me ask you, what different information from the written motions did Knight's attorney present when he got an opportunity for rehearing? What was missing from the first hearing that he was able to shore up?
Well, again, if it's structural error, we don't engage in that nicety test to try to figure that out. So I would urge that first. But to the extent we try to figure those questions out...
The case law that we have as far as structural error or this type of error has to do with preliminary hearings at a critical stage. It's pretty common practice, if not happens like 1,000 times a day in the RJC with 4 courtrooms on every floor of 16 floors, that defense attorneys basically may tell a co-attorney, you know, a co-defendant's attorney, hey, just stand there for me. They have written motions. They have written points and authorities. How is this a critical stage when, and it seems like here in the beginning, it was just mostly a submittal by the attorney on the points and authorities that were written? And I'm just thinking out loud because whether it's Justice Court or District Court, you know, everybody, all the defense attorneys can't be in every department at 9 a.m. It's just impossible. So where is this a critical... Why is this a critical stage if there's points and authorities?
We're not looking to derail that system. Of course, if someone's getting a new date or something's being continued, it's fine to stand in. But if we look at what the Supreme Court has said about what is or isn't a critical stage proceeding, and this own court's precedents, one of the most basic questions is, would it be useful if the defendant had counsel? It's a broad right that depends largely on what are you being called upon to do at that proceeding? And in this case, there were a series of hearings on the motion to sever. Sure, one could make the case that there, at the first hearing, all the attorneys were present, but it was the second and third hearings, largely brought upon by the state's request to submit additional information, that led to the motion being denied. So it wouldn't be any stretch whatsoever. In fact, the better argument is that it would have been useful for Mr. Knight to have his attorney present at those proceedings to protect his interest.
Did Knight object to being represented by his co-defendant's counsel at that hearing?
I don't know that we have it in the record that he objected at that hearing. He certainly provided that objection immediately afterwards.
But didn't he withdraw that objection? And he withdrew it. My understanding is he did make an objection at one point pro se, but then he withdrew it.
What he withdrew, I think, is his request for a different attorney altogether. I think at some point he sought to replace Mr. Coca and then agreed that he would keep with him. So that's my understanding of what it was that he withdrew. He never withdrew his complaint that he should have been represented by his attorney with connection to the motion to sever.
What prejudice can you point to when the jury parsed out different verdicts and didn't find your client guilty on that second incident?
Sure. If we turn to the motion to sever itself, the Supreme Court case, this is a Zafiro that's cited in the briefs, specifically discussed the situation where the jury might find one defendant guilty and another not guilty in what they called a so-called contest between defendants. The specific trial right that could interfere with is either the right to present an individualized defense, such as Mr. Knight having to sit there and listen to, particularly with respect to the second home invasion, what could be classified as overwhelming evidence of Quincy's involvement in that particular incident. None of the evidence pointing directly to Mr. Knight's involvement in that incident. So if the argument by the state at trial is that these guys all know each other, they commit crimes together, they're all family, which is what it was, then the more guilty one or the other, or there was a third co-defendant looks, the guiltier Mr. Knight looks. A second problem is that by having the case tried together with Mr. Knight and Quincy, it led to a situation where there was a so-called second prosecutor, and this was argued by Mr. Knight's attorney in the written briefs, page 76 in the record. But the point simply being that there's a second party altogether there pointing to Mr. Knight's guilt, which should have never been present. And the particular problem with that is that defense lawyers are not subject to the same rules that a prosecutor would be. So when Mr. Quincy Williams' lawyer attempts to dump the whole thing on Mr. Knight, he's not subject to rules or regulations regarding misconduct. He can argue whatever he wants. All right, so to conclude on the motion to sever, I would suggest that there was a specific trial right violated, which is those rights. The other way that you could find relief if you reached the merits of the motion to sever was whether it affected the fairness of the trial altogether. I would simply in brief suggest that if we look at the state court cases, Marshall and Chartier, a series of questions arise which might all fall in Mr. Knight's favor. The defenses were antagonistic, and it was based on more than just self-serving testimony. It wasn't just the two of them pointing fingers at each other. There was this DNA evidence and property found at Mr. Knight's house. I would suggest as well the state used the joint trial to bolster what was a weak case, particularly as to the second and third home invasions. The closing arguments were full of arguments by the state to find Mr. Knight guilty based on his family connection. But there wasn't really any evidence of Mr. Knight's involvement in the second or third home invasion. And then very briefly, I would point out that the court and even the state below on page 105 in the record said that some of the prejudice could be alleviated if there was an appropriate jury instruction. No such instruction was ever given to the jury. So for all those reasons, even if we didn't look for a specific trial right, the joint trial violated the fundamental fairness that Mr. Knight's trial would have required, and you could grant relief just based on that. I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, please. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, thank you. Mr. Resch, we'll give you an even 2 minutes. So I think you went over by about 45 seconds, if I timed it right. So we'll add additional 45 seconds to Ms. Lucich's time and give you a full 2 minutes in rebuttal then. Okay, Ms. Lucich, on behalf of the state.
Thank you. Good morning, Justices. My name is Lisa Lusage, and with Danielle Piper hiding here in the background, we represent the state of Nevada and did all along from the very beginning of the case. The trial court properly did not grant severance in this case as to Mr. Wilbur Knight and Mr. Quincy Williams, and the trial court also did not deny Mr. Williams or Mr. Knight counsel at the hearing on the motion to sever. I would point out that when Mr. Coca filed his motion to sever on March 9th of 2018, he filed a full points and authorities supporting Mr. Knight's position as to why there should be severance. There are many, well, not many, a few judges that don't even allow oral argument on motions. They require that all of your arguments be placed on the briefs and that they make decisions on the briefs. So the fact that Judge Johnson does allow the counsel to argue in addition to the briefs, the parties are fortunate. But on June 12th of 2018, that was the day that the motion was argued. Mr. Coca was there, and he presented a full argument on behalf of Mr. Knight, as did Mr. Hart on behalf of Mr. Williams and Mr. Meningo on behalf of Mr. Black. After argument, the judge had decided that he wanted to review some documents. I think it was the motions, the writ arguments that we had made, but he wanted to review some of the facts from the three incidents and put it over until June 19th. And it was more for of a decision. I don't think any of us, when we went on June 19th, anticipated that we were going to be arguing. But there was argument. Mr. Coca at the time and still has a municipal court track. And when he is involved in the track work in the morning, he can't just break away to run upstairs. So he did ask Mr. Hart to stand in for him for purposes of getting the decision. The judge did allow argument, and Mr. Hart did argue on behalf of Mr. Knight. There was no conflict there. Mr. Knight and Mr. Williams both want the same thing, severance. In the appellant's reply brief, he talks about, well, it's not the same thing because all defendants always want the same thing. They always want to be acquitted. But no, this is a very specific issue. They both wanted severance. They wanted their trials to be severed separately. So Mr. Hart, on behalf of Mr. Knight, was making an argument in order to get the case severed. The judge was leaning actually towards severance and had given the state the ability to provide some more information about why we believed that it was a conspiracy, that they were together. So he enabled me to file a supplement to my opposition. And on June 26th, we were back and argued it again. And unfortunately, Mr. Coca was down in municipal court, so Mr. Hart again stood in for Mr. Coca in arguing for Mr. Black. And the court did deny severance. And the court properly denied severance, by the way. At that hearing on June 26th and on June 19th, Mr. Williams never said, or Mr. Black never said, no, I don't want Mr. Hart to stand in for me. It wasn't until much later when he filed a motion to dismiss Mr. Coca that issue came up, that he's, oh, my attorney should have been there arguing for me and then I would have gotten severance. The court conducted a Young hearing that obviously the state was not present at the time, but because of this appeal, that hearing has been transcribed and provided. The judge actually told Mr. Knight, I wasn't going to grant severance whether Mr. Coca was there or not. So the fact that Mr. Hart argued was of no significance. And then as this court pointed out, the judge did, in fact, give Mr. Coca an opportunity to argue severance yet again on April 26th of 2019. Whether or not I objected to that is a non-issue. The fact is that the court did, in fact, hear from Mr. Black's own attorney, Mr. Coca, about severance, and he still denied severance. But as this court also pointed out, that the district court, the trial judge, has the duty to, all the way through the proceedings, address severance if the court believes it's appropriate and if the court believes that there could be some prejudice. And in fact, Judge Johnson did address severance again on the first day of trial. So there was no conflict of interest here. Mr. Knight was never denied counsel, and that issue is, as I indicated, a non-issue.
Ms. Luzich, this is Justice Silver in Las Vegas. I have a question from the state on your kidnapping charge and the arguments that are proffered by the appellant as to why they should be reversed. Can you give us some argument on why the kidnapping stands and it's not incidental to the robbery?
Of course. Thank you, Judge. In Mendoza, the court talked about what is necessary for the state to show to prove that the offense is not incidental to the kidnapping. And what Mendoza tells us is where there's movement or restraint and it serves to substantially increase the risk of harm to the victim over and above that's necessary to commit the associated offense, or whether the seizure, restraint, or movement of the victim substantially exceed that which is required to complete the associated crime charge. Two different crimes, the underlying crime and the kidnapping, can both lie. And in all three situations, there was significant restraint and movement that exceeded that which was necessary to commit any of the robberies. For example, in the Horv home, they tried to drag Mrs. Horv, Betty Horv, who is older, 70-ish. As I get older, that doesn't seem quite so bad, but she was over 70. She was very, as the detectives described, very frail. She was very anxious. She was panicked. She was sick. And she told them that she was old and frail and sick, and they still tried to drag her up the stairs. That was totally unnecessary. They could have gone all the way through the house.
But wasn't that for purposes of her showing them where valuables were? Wouldn't that be the kind of scenario that's incidental?
That is true. I'm not done yet. Because she was so old and unable to do that, her husband Les kind of volunteered to go. But they dragged him through the house at gunpoint, threatening to kill him if he didn't tell them where the valuables were. That is unnecessary. You don't have to, an old man, you don't have to drag him at gunpoint to get him to tell you where valuables were. And in truth and in fact, the money that they found on their own, not because he told them.
So same scenario, if it's a young man, is it a robbery and not a kidnapping? But if it's an old man, it's a robbery and a kidnapping?
No, I just think that it adds to it that he is older. But afterwards, they zip-tied both of them. Well, actually, during, they zip-tied both of them, and they kicked Betty in the face, hit her in the face, and kicked her in the face. All of that is unnecessary, and it substantially increases the risk of harm to both of them by doing these things. If they were young, that might not have substantially increased the risk of harm, but their age contributed to that. All of that was just unnecessary. They ransacked the house anyway. It wasn't as if they only went to the spots that Les Horv showed them. And as I indicated, the money that they found in the Bible had nothing to do with him. They just found it in there. At the Kameda house, again, they...
Let's go to the third one that he was convicted on.
Mr. Wang. Mr. Wang was also a much older gentleman that had just had surgery. He had been in the hospital for 3 months and could barely move. They beat him over the head and tied him up, which was completely unnecessary to find the money and jewelry and things that they found in the house. He could barely move as it was. But to tie him up, to hit him with the gun, and to hold the blanket over his head so that he couldn't breathe, all of that was just unnecessary to effectuate the robbery. And as far as, I just want to go back to severance for a minute, if I may. The appellant bases his entire argument on a complete misstatement of the facts. The appellant's argument is based on the fact that Brandon Black and only Brandon Black committed the sexual assault, and he claims that the state said that. That is completely untrue. In the Kameda home, there were two separate acts or instances of sexual assault. Brandon Black, who we know to be the individual in the white hoodie, Quincy Williams was the individual in the white shirt. Did I say white hoodie? Red hoodie. I apologize. The initial sexual assault upstairs, which was on the floor, not on the bed, as the appellant indicated, was committed by Brandon Black, and it started in the presence of Tipsuda's daughter. She was like, please, not there, not don't let my daughter see, and they let the daughter go into the room.
But isn't this what you're talking about? He was acquitted on these, on the second incident.
Wilbur Knight was, but it goes to the reason that it should have been tried together. There was a, after Brandon Black sexually assaulted her digitally and tried to put his penis in her, and she got her hand on the gun and shot the gun off, or at least tried to shoot the gun off, and she was yelling. That's when Quincy Williams, who had been downstairs, came upstairs, beat her with the gun, and then he digitally penetrated her. And he was, in fact, convicted of sexual assault with use of a deadly weapon. So there was a sexual assault at the Horv home. One of the men digitally penetrated Betty Horv. At the Kameda home, two of the men, but one was Quincy Williams, we know, digitally penetrated Tipsuda. So when we talk about the fact that their MO or what they do within the house is very similar, that is a huge part of it. But overall, there's a lot more to than just the sexual assault. In all three of these situations, multiple African-American male adults kicked the door in. In the first house, there were three individuals. We know that. Obviously, the state's position is it was Brandon Black, Quincy Williams, and Wilbert Knight. They, while inside at the Kameda home, two people break in and are violent and ransack the house, just as ransacked in the first. But they were on the phone with a third person. While David Kameda and Tip Sirikhan were both downstairs and upstairs, they heard the individual who was with them on the phone with a third person. And I recognize at the Wang house, there were only two individuals. But at each of the houses, the individuals kicked the door in. It's very, very violent. While they are inside, they are carrying guns. They ransack the houses. They're yelling about. I'm sorry.
Can you hear me? I just want to ask a quick question.
Of course.
I want to talk about the Wang conviction. That one seems thin relative to evidence in the others. So when we talk about the joinder, do you think Wang standing alone is a conviction? Without all the other, all the other allegations there? I mean, what do you have
for Mr. Knight?
For Mr. Knight, yeah.
Well, possibly not. I recognize that Mr. Knight doesn't have any DNA left at the scene. He doesn't have an identification by the victim. However, his description is consistent. Independent witness who sees the vehicle at the scene, you know, somewhere in the vicinity of 2:30, they're given a description of the vehicle, and then within hours, Mr. Knight and Mr. Black are found in the vehicle. They're together, by itself, I don't know that there would be enough evidence to convict Wilbur Knight of the Wang robbery. But that's the thing. This is all a conspiracy. The three of them have entered into a conspiracy to do these horrific crimes. The crimes are all basically the same. The violence, the kicking in, the guns, the ransacking. They're all looking for money and jewelry. And they're yelling about money and jewelry, and they take money and jewelry as well as electronics and whatever. And in fact, the property is found at their respective homes. And I recognize that, you know, one set of property is found at the Horv home where Wilbur Knight's DNA is found. One set of property is found at Quincy Williams' home where his DNA is found. And one set of property is found at Brandon Black's home where he was, you know, potentially identified and his vehicle was identified. The conspiracy, the fact that they are together often, they are seen together, they have this familial relationship, it demonstrates that of all the people who you might enter into a conspiracy with, who better than your own family members? Your family members aren't going to tell on you.
Maybe your family members aren't. I don't know about mine.
But I expect that's the thought process behind these individuals. And in fact, they did get away with these three robberies for what they thought was a period of time. One of the reasons we were so careful with having the witnesses talk about things that were found, there were actually eight robberies. We were only able to go forward on three of them, but at their in respective homes, when you saw all of that jewelry and the money and the electronics, it came from not only those three robberies, but many of the others.
We'll have to conclude there. You ran over just a little bit.
I apologize.
Your arguments and, we'll go back to Mr. Resch, and you have 2 minutes, Mr. Resch. You may proceed.
Thank you, Justices. And the state submits that we properly tried this case, and we would ask the court to uphold the convictions.
Mr. Resch.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Appreciate it. All right. 2 minutes. Here we go. The Wayne incident in particular, okay? That evidence is weak. There's nothing other than Mr. Knight being spotted with Brandon Black several hours after the crime at an In-N-Out. So that's evidence that they like hamburgers, but it's not evidence that Mr. Knight participated in that offense. The only other evidence that the state even tries to point to is the description. Yes, one of the offenders was identified as Chubby. The offender identified as Chubby was Brandon Black. Nobody identified Wilbur Knight or described him or anything. And that's the sum total of the evidence connecting Mr. Knight to the Wang incident. So whoever committed that offense, obviously not a very nice person, but I would suggest it's not Mr. Knight, or certainly the state hasn't proven that it was. With respect to the kidnapping at the Wang incident, the evidence gets even thinner. This is on page 2159 in the record. The evidence of so-called movement is moving Mr. Wang from a lying position to a sitting up position. That's it. So again, to the extent that Mr. Knight was somehow associated with that offense, even the kidnapping count could not stand based on that extreme, de minimis movement which occurred. So with the rest of the time, let me go back to the motion to sever real briefly, because what this trial court relied on exclusively, okay, was evidence that the sex crimes connected the offenses, particularly between Mr. Knight and Quincy. But the thing is, as we tried to point out in the reply, the state always knew that it was Brandon Black that was primarily involved in these sex offenses. Never really bothered to tell the trial court about that, leading to the trial court then basing its decision ultimately on the so-called, again, family relationship. But as we see in the record, this is just a quick look at the argument in the briefs. The time between the first incident and the second incident was almost 6 weeks, a little bit long when it comes to concluding that there's a conspiracy simply based on the so-called closeness in time of the offenses. And again, there is evidence that Quincy comes to Wilbert's apartment when Wilbert isn't there because Wilbert lives with Quincy's mom. There is this connection, so to speak, although I hesitate to call it a family connection because Brandon Black is not actually related to anybody, just a guy dating Wilbert.
Mr. Resch, we're going to have to conclude right there. You ran over a little bit as well, so I kind of evened it out with you and the state running over. So
I appreciate it. Thank you.
We'll have to conclude at this time. I want to thank counsel for the excellent arguments and briefs, and we will take this case under submission. We'll be in recess to reconstitute the court for our next oral argument.
Thank you, Justices.